Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Her very name has become part of the American lexicon, Sister Souljah, as in Sister Souljah moment, when a politician in the spotlight denounces a controversial figure for political gain, as in Bill Clinton and Sister Souljah 1992. Since then, she's moved on from Public Enemy and rap to some hugely successful writing. Her first novel of tough urban life, The Coldest Winter Ever, was a million seller. Now she's out with a prequel called Midnight. It's controversial in a brand new way, and at a moment when Barack Obama is about to move into the White House. This hour, On Point, Sister Souljah. Joining me now from New York is Sister Souljah, writer, rapper, entertainer, lecturer. She came into the general public's eye after then-candidate Bill Clinton criticized her comments on the L.A. riots in 1992. She was an activist and rapper back then, a raptivist, she called herself. She joined the group Public Enemy for a while. In 1996, she brought out her memoir, No Disrespect, and then The Coldest Winter Ever, a best-selling novel that helped spur a still-rising genre of urban lit. Now, nearly a decade later, after spending time working for Sean P. Diddy Combs, she's out with a new novel, Midnight, a gangster love story. Sister Souljah, welcome to On Point.
Peace. Thank you, Tom. I'm very happy that you have me on the air today.
We're very happy to have you. And I've got like a million or two questions for you.
Okay.
And let's just dive in. I don't know if this is the tough stuff or easy for you, but you've got this famous quote that hangs around in the era of Wikipedia. We all live with everything we ever say or do. You said, and I'm not sure what the year was, "I'm not saying there aren't any decent white people. I've just never met one." Sister Souljah, circa, I don't know what date. Now that Barack Obama has been elected, what do you say?
Well, first of all, in reference to the comment or the so-called quote, I can't say that I said that. Most of the things that I've said historically have been taken out of context, and I'm good at saying what I mean and meaning what I say. And if you ask me, I'll tell you exactly what I mean and exactly what I'll say. But I can't make you any promises about what somebody said I said.
Okay.
That's a whole different topic.
Well, let's just be right here, right now, then. I mean, because,
yes,
you still come out of the hip hop world, out of a period of rap lyrics that were really loaded with racial pride and racial anger. That's not news to anybody.
Right. That's a fact.
That's on tape. That's on the disc.
That's a fact.
And within that time, you know, you were fist up loud and proud with a message that could be pretty angry sometimes and very critical of fellow Americans, white Americans. You're pretty critical of black Americans in your new book in many ways. But how has this election changed, or has it changed your view of this country in racial terms and social terms and who we are and how we get along?
Well, I don't know if I would use those words to phrase what I see happening right now. I'm happy that Barack Obama was able to win and is now the president-elect of the United States of America. I think that he fought like a champion during that campaign and that he had excellent endurance and a great thinker's mind and great strategy, and I'm really proud of that. I'm also going to say that, of course, it's a measure of improvement that there were white people that went to the polls and voted for Obama, that listened to him and could see clearly that he was the better candidate. At the same time, what does it say about race in America? Well, it says a lot about the condition of America today, period, not just in the category of race. Mm-hmm. I think that people were exhausted from the Bushes, just exhausted from George Bush, W. Bush, and exhausted from his father. I think that they looted the country and handed it to Barack Obama in a very broke down shape and condition. And I think it's going to be very difficult, but not impossible, for Barack Obama to put his mind and his experiences to the task of trying to clean up after the Bushes.
What does it say to you, coming out of the hip-hop world, the rap world, a lot of anger in that world, that the African-American who moves into the White House is this famously no-drama Obama, very silky guy who doesn't avoid the heavy stuff? I mean, he stood up and talked more directly about race to this country maybe than anyone ever has in a campaign context. But he's the opposite of your rap image guy, of your hip-hop image guy. This is the no-drama Obama. Is that a rebuke to the rap world, or how do you see that?
Not at all. I don't agree that he's the no-drama Obama. I think that he delivers his presentations with intelligence and common sense and passion. That's the same way that I see myself. I'm a graduate of Rutgers University. Mm-hmm. He's a graduate of Harvard. I consider my voice to be silky. I consider myself to be intelligent and brilliant and soothing. And I don't consider myself to be angry. I consider myself to be a political analyst or a historical analyst, or somebody who can look at history, somebody who can do research, synthesize information, and make constructive criticisms and not backpedal from that.
Fair enough. And you're in a different genre. You're doing a different thing. But you've got language. I mean, and you never set out to be a politician or to be elected. But
right.
In 1992, I mean, you're recording The Hate That Hate Produced, Soulja. This is your lyric. Soulja was not born to make white people comfortable. I am African first. I am black first. I want what is good for my people first.
Me and my people first.
How does that sound in 2008? Is that a message out of history? Is that old fashioned?
That sounds
wonderful
to me. That sounds wonderful to me, and of course, it's still relevant. I think back then I was trying to teach my own community that it's not just about integrating in terms of just being the black face in the place.
Mm-hmm.
It's about power. It's about the redistribution of power. It's about access. It's about the elimination of racism. It's about the elimination of institutional racism. And it's about knowing what your interests are and getting in there and fighting for your interests without apologizing and without playing the role of the slave. And so I still stand by that. I think that that's very important. And when other people of other races go into the White House, you know, if they're Irish or whatever they are, they're proud of that. And I think that should be the same for African people, that if we make it to the White House, we should be proud of that. We shouldn't have to hide our heritage or our culture or play down the injustices that we've suffered. There have been many groups of people that have suffered various degrees, and they are able to discuss it and able to say who did it and able to say how they feel about it and able to have museums about it. And I think that we should be able to do the same.
The Irish president can wear the green in the White House and an African-American president, the equivalent, you say. And yet, Sister Soulja, here's Barack Obama. He's going to be president of all the people. I mean,
and
we come to understand the president's role, maybe above all, as seeing all equally, treating all equally, not privileging in any group. I mean, can he meet your expectations as an African American leader and an all American leader at the same time? Can he do both?
Well, here's the fact. Like I said, I'm a graduate of Rutgers University. Mm-hmm. I study things and I understand the difference between one thing and another. He is the president of the United States of America, which means that he is, of course, the president of all the people. And so I'm not looking for him to be the African-American leader. I think that there are still community leaders and activists and African-American leaders and civil rights firms and, you know, black revolutionaries and people whose jobs are not outmoded because Barack Obama is the president. Their jobs still exist and their jobs still should exist. I'm expecting Barack Obama to do the same thing that any president in his position would do, represent all the people and have certain pet projects for his own people and certain benefits for his own people and while representing all the people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know how the game is played in Washington. It's not all straight dealing.
Though our expectation of a president, our expectation is that it will be straight deal. I mean, that's our hope, right? That's
Well, I think it's naive.
Job.
I think it's naive for, I mean, is George Bush a straight dealer? I mean, come on, give me a break. I think it's naive to think that anything is straight in politics. I think that President-elect Barack Obama has the best intention. And believe me, that's a big, big help and a big, big start. I think that he's trying to assemble a team that can carry out his best intention and his best state of mind. And hopefully that will happen. But the bottom line is there'll always be little preferences no matter who you are, no matter what race you are. There'll always be pet projects, things that people feel more passionately about because of their background, because of their culture, because of their experiences. And so I expect to see those same kind of things that I would see in any president of the United States of America.
Barack Obama says he wants a new kind of politics. Everybody's going to be watching very closely to see exactly what that means. We're getting a sense here of expectations from Sister Solja. She joins us today from New York. Her new novel, and we'll talk about it as soon as we come back from a short break, is Midnight, a Gangster Love Story. Here she is from her 1992, The Hate That Hate Produced. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Sister Solja about Barack Obama, Black America, White America, and her new novel, Midnight, a Gangster Love Story. We've got listeners calling in. Leslie in Northampton, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Sister Solja.
Hi.
Hi.
Actually, my comment was more for you and the premise of the show, unfortunately.
Go at it.
I just, you know, I cried my eyes out when Barack Obama won the presidency. I thought it was a wonderful thing. But I am concerned that people now think that some big change has come to America, and I don't think so. I think that racism is deep, deep, deep down in the corners and in the cracks and on the surface and underneath and all through our culture, and we need to really stay vigilant about that and keep working on it. And, you know, I think if there was a lot less racism, he would have won by a landslide because he was clearly, you know, by far the better candidate, and the race for presidency was just filled with racism.
Right, but let me ask you, and we'll put it to Sister Solja, but I mean, no question, we've got a deep history of race, and one election doesn't make it go away, and we've got realities of it right now. But in a time when Obama's calling for new politics, new relationships, what about the anger of the school that Sister Solja's come out of? What's the place for that now, in your mind, Leslie?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I think, first of all, I have to say that somebody asked me if I was black or white when I made my call, and I didn't tell you, but because I didn't think that was an issue, because I do think white
Fine.
People, which I am, do have the right to speak about racism.
Sure.
But I honestly, from what I've seen, I feel like black people hardly ever get to talk about how hurt or angry they are without constantly being harassed about it. Like any time I hear a black person want to talk about slavery or racism or lynching or, you know, the fact that, you know, a lot of the homeless people walking the streets in New York City today are African American or whatever, like anything to do with racism, people go, oh, they're playing the race card
right.
blah, 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 blah. And it's really unbelievably offensive, and I think white people need to sit back and say, wait a minute, you know, people have the right to speak about their anger and their pain without me trying to shut them up.
Leslie, we've got it, and we will talk about it. Let me get another call here from Jefferson City, Missouri first. Brian, you're on the air. Hi, Brian. What do you know?
Hey, wanted to bring this subject up to you. I guess probably about a couple weeks ago I was listening to a show, and they had a Republican operative on there who stated that, well, now that Barack Obama is our president-elect, that, you know, they should get rid of the black caucuses and some of the other caucuses as far as with the Latinos and all of that. And also, and one other quick thing in reference to what the young lady that just got off the phone, what she had talked about. You know, I'm a black male. I have my college degree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you always hear about, I guess as they call it, the American dream. You know, you work, you stay, you get your education, you stay out of trouble. You know, and good things are happening for you. And you know, it's a situation where, you know, since I've gotten my degree, I've had problems getting a job because I'll go into interviews, and when I go in, the people would do a double take when I go in the office because I know they're probably thinking that, well, we thought he was a white guy. But, you know, it's that's an issue that, you know, like she was saying, as far as being black, I mean, it you know, and I don't use black as a crutch or as an excuse, but at the same time, I mean, there's a lot that goes along with being black, and you know, and it's tough out there, but you know, you just have to push on. But just wanted to get your comments on those two issues.
We'll do it, Brian. Thank you. Sounds like you still felt a headwind, Sister Soldier. There you got Leslie and Brian. Leslie says there's still a place for anger. History means it, and Brian. Listening to the GOP saying maybe you don't need a black caucus anymore. You've got a black president now.
Right. Of course, I know that we still need the Congressional Black Caucus. And like I said, we still need the community activists, the black activists, the revolutionary activists. We still need all of that because even though President-elect Barack Obama is in position to become the president of the United States of America, there are problems that were put into place by a system that was in place for a long time and still is in place. There are so many problems in our communities across the country that we still need to organize around those problems. We still need to create solutions to those problems. We still need to create legislation that addresses those problems. So there's a lot of work to be done. And anybody who thinks that just because Mr. Obama, Senator President-elect Obama is going to the White House, that all the problems will be solved on January 20th or 21st or what have you, is naive.
There's a Sister Soldier view. Let's get Dion in Bristol, Connecticut. Dion, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point with her is, like, I don't say what she's doing is bad, but I do feel that black Americans need to do more for themselves and stop complaining about racism exists. No matter where you go, it's among black people, it's among white people, it's among every race of people. I feel that we as black need to do more for ourselves, and we need to be more for our family, for our neighborhood. And I think the issue, she sounds very angry, and I think Barack Obama is an excellent president, the fact that he ran without having anything skeleton come out of the closet. But I come from a country where we have all different people run for the president, actually from prime minister. But I think that black
what
Americans
country is
need
that?
More.
What,
from Jamaica, actually.
Jamaica, yeah.
Yeah, and okay. I find that as I have a lot of friends who are Africans, and we all talk, and we all find that black Americans are, we don't say they're lazy, but they have a lot of opportunities to do great in this country, and like they squander that opportunity. I own my own business, and I do great in my business, and all my other friends, we always talk that the issue of always race. Race exists anywhere. And a lot of people say, oh, well, I can't get a job because I'm black. I don't believe that. I just think you have to do a little bit harder. Sometimes you might have to relocate where you live to get a better job.
Dion, we've got it. Sister Soldier, this gets right to the new book, but first your response to Dion.
Well, Dion, I think that you're mixing up the issues, and I understand why you're doing that, because there's a whole school of thought that has just become a heap of stereotype. But the bottom line is this. I, for instance, am an activist that will talk about race, should talk about race. I live in a country that is and was under the grip of race and racism, which is a system that puts people in a lesser position, not because of anything else other than their race. I own a business. I graduated from college. I've made more than $1 million. I've done all the things you said we should do. I'm married. I've been with my husband for 19 years. I have a 15-year-old son. I own property. But this doesn't make me think for 1 minute that I should not protect my political rights or the political rights of my people or the political rights of my community. This doesn't make me think for 1 minute that I don't have to fight for stronger economic rights. This doesn't make me think for 1 minute that I don't have to represent the interests of young kids who are coming from the projects and urban areas where I grew up, who may not have parents that are advocates on their behalf. So I don't think that people who are discussing these issues are fitting in the stereotype that you're talking about of not being intelligent or not being business owners or not having money or not understanding the issue. It's not that we don't understand the issue. It's that we do understand the issue. And therefore, we must work hard, very, very hard. But we must also fight at the same time.
Though there is a pretty tough critique of a lot of African-Americans in your new book, Midnight, at least in the mouths of the characters you've got here. We'll look at that. Let me get one call before we do. Abdul in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Abdul, you're on the air with Sister Soldier.
Yes, hello, Sister Soldier and Brother Tom.
Hi.
My name is Abdul Wahid Muhammad. I just finished reading The Coldest Winter Ever last week for the first time. I was told that I was late, but I got a late edition that had a character analysis at the end of the book with a series of questions that you were asked about a wonderful book, a book that I think about those that read it, pulling the moral out of it and hearing the after comments that you made, if the way that the book ended, did they get that moral truth that were presented in the multi-layered characters? But Midnight being the core of the book was the analysis that presents what we're speaking of when we speak of Obama, of the core of America right now as we stand here is a discussion of Obama, why he was elected, how prophetic it is, and what's going to take place in the afterwards. So when I hear that a prequel of The Coldest Winter Ever as a book of probably I'm definitely seeing that it's the story of Bilal.
Yes. Yes, it is. And it's been it entered as number 7 on the New York Times bestsellers list. It's selling very well.
million copies out there. That's a big number. And now Midnight, and you've got a fan in Abdul, but for our listeners who haven't read it, who are even later than Abdul, Sister Soldier, could you introduce us just to this, because this is a prequel, in a nutshell, the story of The Coldest Winter Ever is?
The story The Coldest Winter Ever is a cautionary tale about drugs, not just people using them, but the people selling them. And it's told through a teenage black female living in Brooklyn whose father has a drug dealing empire. And she basically tries to live a celebrity carefree life in the projects and then out in Long Island. And what we see is the decline of a drug dealing empire that basically for the first time, instead of chronicling the rise and the glamour and the Scarface and the Godfather, this book chronicles the decline of the empire. And you see basically her and her entire family and her entire neighborhood unravel in The Coldest Winter Ever.
Now, her name is Winter. In that book, there's a character named Midnight. He's a young man who has immigrated to the U.S. from Sudan. He is the main character in the new prequel, Midnight, and he comes out of Sudan, out of an Islamic background. He's immigrated with his mother, not his father, who stayed behind, a very high-level, rich guy in Sudan. They find themselves in the tough life in New York. I wish you'd read a little bit for us. I mean, he lays it on the line. This is from page 2 of Midnight, how he looks at American-born African-American men. Could you read a bit for us, Sister Soldier?
I don't come from where you come from. I don't think like you do. My whole situation is different. I come from a country of real men who take real life real serious. I wouldn't trade places with an American-born man for any amount of cash. Where I'm from, a son has a first name and 3 last names. The 3 last names are the names of his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather. Any male who cannot identify his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather is already lost. These 3 names are what makes a boy who he is. There is no talk of role models and celebrities. A son is raised under his father's wing with a grandfather to guide and a great-grandfather as a blueprint, plus an army of uncles nearby. Where I'm from, a man does not bow down to any other man. A man bows down only to Allah. Only Allah created the heavens, the galaxies, the universe, and all of the millions of creatures within. My father had 3 wives, not 1 wife, 1 wifey, and a bunch of random bitches on the side. Where I am from, a man wants to marry a woman and establish a strong family. A man can have more than one wife as long as he can treat them all fairly and provide them with love, separate homes, food, guidance, and presence. There's no such thing as domestic drama. A woman feels fortunate to be selected by a quality husband, a family man who will be by her side for her entire lifetime. Families are permanent.
Sister Solja, reading from her new novel, Midnight, and there the voice in the book of the lead character, Midnight, an immigrant from Sudan who throughout this book is very, very critical of a lot of urban African-American culture. Wow, he sounds like a Sudanese Bill Cosby.
Actually, he's critical of American culture. People mistakenly say that he's critical of African-American culture, but he is critical of American culture. And of course, African-American culture is a huge reflection of American culture.
But you've got black readers responding here saying, wait a minute, let us up. Okay, you know, some critique, but this is pretty heavy. I mean, what's the perspective or the lesson you're looking to impart here?
Well, this is fiction, and the voice of the main character is a Muslim teenager, and he's from an Islamic state. And when I write, the same way that I wrote the character went to Santiago, who was an African-American teenage girl, I was very true to her voice. There's no point in The Coldest Winter ever where Winter Santiago sounds like Sister Solja, the author. She always sounds like a 13 to 18-year-old teenage Brooklyn female who is very hood in her orientation. The same holds true with Midnight Against a Love Story. I don't think I dropped the rhythm, the thought pattern, or the voice of a young teenage male even once. I don't think I interjected Sister Solja's voice even once. So what you're getting is the raw character. And just imagine if you came from a country that is essentially an Islamic country where people stop all day, five times a day, to say their prayers, and where women are covered from head to toe, what type of a cultural shock you may experience in arriving here in the United States of America, and what kind of comparison you would be doing in your mind between the women from home and the women here, and the families back home and the families here, the neighborhoods back home and the neighborhoods here. So what happens in Midnight Against a Love Story is you get this true voice from this young male character, and you get to experience his version of love, all of the females that he meets, the way he sees them, the way he interacts with them, the way he thinks about them, and the way he loves them.
Sister Solja's new novel is Midnight, a Gangster Love Story. This the prequel to her big seller, The Coldest Winter Ever. She joins us today from New York City. We're going to take a short break here. We'll go out with Tupac Shakur, I Ain't Mad At Ya. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Swole, remember when you had a Jerry curl, didn't quite learn. On the block with your Glock, tripping off Sherm. Collect calls to the tilt, saying how you changed. Oh, you a Muslim now, no more dope games. Heard you might be coming home, just got bail. Wanna go to the mosque, don't wanna chase tail. It seems I lost my little homie, he's a changed man. Hit the pen and now no sinning is the game plan. When I talk about money... I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Sister Solja about Barack Obama, Black America, White America, and her new novel, Midnight, a Gangster Love Story. The lead character in Midnight, a young man from the Sudan named Midnight, says, Sister Solja writing here for him, he says, our women know their place. They stay in it and live and thrive there. They remain there happily. Our women give love and are loved even more. She is respected, protected, and provided for. She lives proud and at peace. And he says, when I talk about where I am from, that is Sudan, which is almost never, he's the strong, silent type, both males and females, that is Americans, feel uneasy. But I feel fine. People where I am from are happy, while almost everybody I know in America feels empty and dissatisfied, especially the black people. 800-423-TALK is our number. Kenneth is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Kenneth, what do you think?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I've been following Sister Soldier since I seen her on Gil Noble back when I lived in Brooklyn, like some 20 years ago.
That's back. That's back. You were early.
Yeah. And I wanted to say that Jay-Z, growing up in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Jay-Z isn't an angry black rapper or anything like that. Puffy's in hip-hop. And this is addressing the statement you said earlier, how hip-hop is angry, hip-hop is those negative things. And I've actually found it not to be that, having grown up a black man in Brooklyn, New York. But nevertheless, going for my MBA now, I find that there are a lot of Africans and a lot of West Indians in my classes, and they seem to have a bias against African-Americans, as well as West Indians in my family, and they tend to believe African-Americans are lazy. But looking at history, I can't believe that's a fact, because if we were lazy, the majority of them wouldn't be here, because there would have been no civil rights movement, no civil war, winning for the North, and lots of other things that transpired because we are not a lazy people. But nevertheless, I also wanted to say that in my MBA program, there needs to be a mind shift, because there's a culture, and it's an interesting one.
Mm.
Those countries in Africa, those people coming out of certain parts of Africa that have been colonized, they have a different mindset than, say, the Ethiopians or the Eritreans or even the Sudanese, because those folks were not as colonized as the folks who were on the East Coast or the main parts of Africa. So they are not as negative or as angry, because they come over with a certain amount of anger and a different cultural background and sensitivity. We operate from a different operandi, because we have a different experience under slavery and colonialism, etc.
Yeah.
But those things need to be addressed within their own race and we within our own culture. But I think Sister Soldier is right, because you need people, you need that anger for change. And it's not a blind anger. It's an intelligent anger. Like she said, she can synthesize information. She's a critical thinker. She's an analytical thinker. And we all are. And Barack is needed, but racism still exists. Living in Atlanta, Georgia, knowing that Georgia was a red state, that's kind of embarrassing for me. But for the most part, I'm proud of white folks because they put him in office. But it's interesting, because McCain wouldn't have had that much of a fight if Barack wasn't black. You know, he wouldn't
that's
have had
right.
the majority of those folks for him and those sort of things. So that's all I wanted to say. So you guys have a great day. Sister Soldier, great hearing from you.
Thank you.
Going back 20 years, Kenneth, great to have you. Thank you very much. Sister Soldier, what do you say to Kenneth?
Amen. I agree with everything that he said.
Let's
keep it moving.
Well, let me. Good. I'm with you. Let me ask you about here. You've got Midnight. He's from Sudan. He's got a lot to say, and he's not afraid to, in his quiet way, his strong, silent way, as you characterize him, to lecture, at least to us, the reader. What do you think African Americans have to learn from African culture, from the culture, let's say, that your character, Midnight, represents?
I think that American culture, because, again, I'm not saying African-American culture. I'm saying American culture, everybody here.
But you do say especially the black people, through the mouth of your character Midnight here, feeling empty
right,
and dissatisfied.
But I'm Sister Soldier talking
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not Midnight. I'm
Fair
Sister
enough.
Soldier.
We got that.
And you asked me the question.
Okay,
so
to you.
I'm giving you my answer. I'm not giving you Midnight's
okay.
answer. I think that what we stand to learn in America has to do with the value of family, the relationship of sex, morality, religion, spirituality, to the creation of a strong family and a strong family foundation. I think that if you watch television in 2008 in the United States of America, and you go to the movies and you read all of this material, that it encourages young people to have sex, to be sexual. The only real responsibility that young people are given is to wear a condom. But I think that there's so much more to sex than just the wearing of a condom. I think that how families are put together, and what the real definition of love is, and what the real definition of discipline is, and all of these kinds of moral, spiritual, psychological, cultural issues that we consider to be not part of our political process because of the separation of church and state. I still think that some of these issues need to move to the forefront of our dialogue, because I think we're losing a lot of families of all races in America, because we have just encouraged what I perceive to be the worst kind of moral behavior. I mean, some of the leading icons, whether it's Britney Spears or Paris Hilton or Nicole Richie, some of the leading visual images that people get, or the celebrities that just get married and get divorced and get married and get divorced and get married and get divorced. I think the message that we're sending to the world as the exporter of these images is not a good one. And I think that we need not only a political overhaul, as President-elect Barack Obama says, but I think we need a spiritual overhaul. I think we need a cleansing.
So is that, have you got in midnight a Sudanese Bill Cosby? I mean, is that, I'm having fun, maybe too much, but you know what I'm saying?
You're having fun by yourself, Tom.
Yes, yeah. Woohoo, let's go. But I mean, it kind of sounds like
it. I wouldn't call him Sudanese Bill Cosby. I wouldn't use that phrase, but that's your thing.
Okay, Shirley, in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you, Sister Soldier?
Peace. How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. I was just calling to say thank you for writing the book, Cold as Winter Ever. I was able to reread it after recommending it to a friend and got a chance to reread it and didn't know that there was one out with the character analysis at the end. And also got a chance to finish reading Midnight, A Gangsta Love Story. So I just want to say you thank you for the work that you're doing and showing a different side of a different tale of African American.
Shirley, so you've read the new one. What do you make of the portrayal of, let's say, African-American women in this book, Midnight?
Well, you know, you can't determine who you're going to fall in love with. I just think that that's a divine intervention. And I have two teenage daughters, and my mother-in-law talks to my 14-year-old about not marrying someone of the other race, but with the browning of America, I don't think that she really has a, not I shouldn't say she shouldn't have, that she doesn't have a choice, but it's so many interracial marriages that it's okay. It didn't bother me. It's just talking about love, and you can't determine what color person you're going to fall in love with.
Midnight, in this book, ends up falling in love, actually, with a Japanese girl, Akemi Nakamura, in the book. But what about the tough portrayal, the way African-American women are described by Midnight? In his words, Sister Soldier, only the author. Were you offended? Were you nodding along with it, Shirley? What?
Nodding along with it, yeah. Because she just speaks the truth, you know.
But Sister Soldier, I'm reading.
It sounds like you have something to say, Tom. Well, have you finished reading the book?
I read a lot of it last night, and I'm reading a.
But you didn't read enough of it.
Oh, I read a lot, and so did Sharon Hall. She's got a blog, Sugar Flavored Freedom. She writes the book. Finally, went overboard with the Islamic cues and the African American woman bashing. She said all of the sisters in this book who were American were nasty whores, tramps, loose, lost, and confused women from the youngest on up.
Not true. That's how I know who reads the book and who doesn't read the book.
That's a pretty good review. She says, why, Sister Soldier, why?
But are you in the position to say it's a good review if you haven't read the book, Tom?
I've read a whole lot of it. I've read hundreds of pages.
See, that's the problem.
Huh?
What happens
No, that's too easy. That's too easy. It's a smart woman who read your book and she's reviewing it.
Let me respond. There's a group of people who are reading internet chatter. But see, when an author takes the time to write a book, especially a 500-page book, that means that every single word has a meaning and a purpose, and every story and subplot has a context.
Hey, I wish
that's
I had Sharon Hall on the line. I'm pretty sure she's got it all under her belt here.
I can tell that you wish you had her on the line because all the callers have been so positive.
I'm not negative. I'm just saying she's asking.
Okay. I don't mind what she's asking, but she's not on the line asking me. And what I can tell you in response to your comments is that one of the best things you can do with a book is read it. And see, once you read it, you can speak from an intelligent place. But if you don't read it, or you read what somebody else who says they read it says, then you're not responding from an intelligent place. It's like when you're doing research, there are primary sources and there are secondary sources and there are tertiary sources. So right now what you're doing is tertiary, and what would be better.
That's too easy. I read too much of it to be tertiary.
Actually, That's too easy. No. What page are you on? What page and what chapter?
I'm all the way to the end. Now, did I was
oh,
I a little fast?
Yes, Tom,
I am.
Lying.
I am
Tom,
slow. Was I a little? No way. I was a little fast lying. In the middle. It was a long night. But,
don't make me quiz you like I quiz my students, because if I quiz you, you're going to get a big, fat, juicy F.
I don't think
F
so.
F is in failure.
I don't think. Shirley in Nashville, thank you for calling. Ms. Rock in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Sister Soldier.
Hi.
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 Originally, I'm from Ethiopia, and I vote for Obama because he is very intelligent, and he graduated from Harvard. Yes, this is historical. However, when the media address President-elect, they always call him the first African-American. What about his mom is white? So how do we address him? Is he African-American?
Well, let me ask you first, Ms. Ruck. We had Barack Obama on this show. We asked him, are you African-American? He said, well, yes, by definition.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Just because my degree is in history, so let me just answer your question. The history of America stands as such that if you have a drop of African blood, you are considered to be of color. You are considered to be an African person. There was actually a way of measuring the amount of drops of African blood you have. For example, calling people octoroons or quadroons, and actually breaking it down to a mathematical equation as to what person gave you the drop of blood and how much of that blood you have. So actually, we as a community, meaning the African American community, are accustomed to welcoming and accepting and loving everyone as African Americans who have even a drop, because that was the American legislation. That is the history of the United States of America.
So when you look at Barack Obama, what about his mother? The question Ms. Rock raises, how does she figure into your understanding of this full man, Sister Soldier?
Well, she figures in like any mother does. I mean, there's no way to factor out anyone's mother. It doesn't matter what race they are. A mother is the most powerful person next to God, in my opinion. You're not going to get any more influence than that. So I don't know what you want me to say, but I'm not factoring his mom out. I mean, his mom is his mom.
Fair enough. Straight up. Ms. Rock, thanks for your call. Jessica in West Wardsboro, Vermont. You're on the air with Sister Soldier.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, I know you're running out of time, so I'll be quick, but I'm white, but I grew up in Yonkers, New York. I went to elementary school where I was a minority, and I know how it feels. And I just grew up with a lot of sympathy for African-American people. And I think by no means is your fight over. I think you should keep doing exactly what you're doing and spreading the message. And I'm so hopeful for our new president. And I have an 8-month-old daughter, and I'm just really hopeful for this world that she's growing up into because of people like you. And I'm just really inspired by the books that you've written. And
I just
want to say thank you for everything.
What did you say your name was?
Jessica Perkins from West Virginia.
Jessica Perkins.
Well, born Jessica Siegler from Yonkers, New York, but now I'm a country girl, so again, I'm a minority. I'm a city girl in the country.
Right. Jessica,
well,
thank you very much. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you so much. What about
Tom, it seems to be a landslide.
Hey, go for it.
Barack Obama's in and Sister Soldier's in.
Let's ride
on. 2009.
Are you down with Jessica's hope? Are you feeling hopeful, Sister Soldier?
Listen, let me tell you something. I am not the type of person who just likes to complain. I love my life. I enjoy my life. I live it to the fullest. If there's a real problem, I assess it and I start working on the solution. If there's some kind of discrimination, I address it. If I'm a victim of racism or somebody else's, I'll fight for them. But the bottom line is that we've had some impact, people that do the kind of work that I do. And we are now experiencing a certain pieces of victory. I think that Oprah Winfrey has done a wonderful job in teaching white America a lot of morality, civility, spirituality, things that were not common factors in their experience and in their everyday lives. So I'm happy that the work of people like Oprah Winfrey and people like myself, maybe on the other side of Oprah Winfrey and everybody in between and on the other sides of us, I'm happy that we are experiencing some growth and some movement. And if there are young white people who want to be positive, who want to divorce themselves from the history of racism and discrimination and just a lack of civility, I embrace that.
We'll take
wholeheartedly.
That. We'll take that. We'll take that for today. We'll take that and say thank you very much. Sister
thank
Soldier,
you, Tom.
The new novel is Midnight, a gangster love story. Thank you very much for being with us. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too. And if you finish that book, you will love it.
I'm on your case. Thank you very much for being here. Midnight is the book. Sister Soldier joins us from New York. We'll go out with her. Slavery is back in effect from 1992. That's a few years back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Once again.